The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. In his new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us, Paul Tough challenges conventional wisdom about higher education and asks the simple but profound question, does college work? To hear Tara Westover tell it in her recent review, the answer is a resounding yes. But for whom? And how are the benefits distributed? She goes on to note the book is indelible and extraordinary, a powerful reckoning with just how far we've allowed reality to drift from our ideals. Paul Tough is the author of three previous books, including the best-selling How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and The Hidden Power of Character, which has been called a persuasive wake-up call to the deprivations of knowledge suffered by American kids from both extremes of the economic spectrum. And Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America. Concluding her critique of The Years That Matter Most, Westover ends with these sobering words. Reading Tough, you cannot fail to notice that we have allowed the inequities of our economic system to be reproduced in our education system, and that the result is poisoning our politics. We then ask ourselves why so many Americans no longer believe in college or degrees or facts or science. We can also ask the author. Please welcome Paul Tough.
Hello, everyone. Good evening. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you to Andy for that introduction. Very kind, very generous. It's a real honor to be here. It's exciting for me to be in Philadelphia and to have all of you here. This is a big week for me because this is the beginning of my book tour. My book just came out 2 days ago, so I still have a newborn keeping me up all night and crying and doing all the things that newborns do, except in this case it's a book. And it's a big deal for me that this book is finally published because it took a lot of work. I spent 6 years working on it. I visited 21 different states in my reporting, talked to hundreds of students, high school students and college students, and hundreds of experts, administrators, researchers, educators of all kinds. And the question that I was trying to answer while I did all of this was to try to understand the relationship between in the United States today between these two great American themes, higher education and social mobility. And in the past, the relationship between those two things was pretty clear in the United States. Higher education was the great engine of social mobility. It was the vehicle that could reliably move young people from low-income families to the middle class and from the middle class to affluence. But something has gone wrong with that engine. It has broken down in some way. And now when you talk to young people, especially young people who live in families without a lot of money, what they tell you is that higher education more often feels like the obstacle to their social mobility, the barrier that is keeping them from their dreams rather than helping them realize it. So what I try to do in the book is understand how and why and when that happened. I try to describe what it is like to be a young person today in the middle of that system, trying to make it work for yourself. And then I try to propose a few things that we might be able to change to make it work better again. So I'm going to talk for about 30 minutes about the book, then I'm looking forward to taking questions from you all, and then I'd be happy to sign some books. So I want to start this talk with a story. And the story I want to start with is the same story that I begin the book with. It takes place on a park bench in a park called St. Nicholas Park in West Harlem in New York City. And on a cold March afternoon a couple of years ago, I walked out of the subway into this park, and I was there to meet a young woman, a student, a high school senior at a high school nearby, and her name was Shannon Torres. And I had met Shannon a couple of times before, and she was this very kind of cool Dominican girl from the Bronx. She had this sort of science nerd mixed with skate punk vibe that I found a little intimidating. She was really cool. But on this particular day, she was not acting cool at all. She seemed anxious and nervous and upset. And when I asked her what was going on, she explained that it was March the 30th, and it was 4:15 p.m. And at 5 p.m. on March 30, every Ivy League college simultaneously releases all of their acceptances and rejections. And she had applied to two Ivy League colleges. One was Princeton, and the other was Penn, some local color. And Penn, as it turned out, was her dream school. It was the place that she wanted to go more than anything else, anywhere else. It was the thing that she wanted more than anything else. And in 45 minutes, sitting there on that park bench, checking her phone, she would find out whether her dream would come true or not. So I think of myself as a pretty savvy reporter, right? So it would be great if I could tell the story about how I had planned this all out, and I could give speeches to journalism students explaining, like, you gotta just look at your calendar, you gotta know what everyone's doing, pay attention to your sources, follow the different threads in their lives. But in fact, I had no idea when I got there that this was about to be happening. But I quickly understood that this was a key 45 minutes in Shannon's life. And so we sat there and we talked together, and she explained to me what was going on and how she was feeling and what this meant to her. And as she did, she seemed to come progressively more and more undone. Her hands were trembling, she was growing teary, and through it all, she talked to me about what it felt like. And the way she put it was, I've been working my whole life for this one thing. And she had. She was a brilliant student and an extremely hard-working student, and she had always been done really well in school. In her high school, in the front hall, they posted this big yellow card with the names of all the top students ranked in each class. And beginning in her first semester in freshman year, she had been in the very top slot for her class, and she had stayed in that top slot every single semester until the current one. She was almost finished senior year. She was sure to be the valedictorian. And she hadn't missed a single day of high school in 4 years. And she wasn't one of those kids, though, for whom, you know, being number one came really easy. She worked tremendously hard. She would stay up until 2 or 3 o'clock every morning, making sure her homework was done exactly right, long after her mom told her that she should give up and go to bed. And yet, despite all that, she was not a grind. She really loved school. She loved learning. She was a science person. She wanted to be a paleontologist. But she also loved literature and books. Her favorite book is Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. And so when you are a young person like that at a school like hers, after a while people start talking to you about college. And they start saying, you're not only going to go to college, you're going to go to a great college, to an Ivy League college. And at first this seemed kind of crazy to Shannon. No one in her family had ever gone to college. Not too many people in her neighborhood in the South Bronx had been to college. And yet as time went on, and as she continued to do well and get different sorts of scholarships and awards, she came to understand that this was actually a real plausible possibility to go to a college like this, and that if she did get in, she would likely get full financial aid because of her family's financial circumstances. And so it started to seem like a reality or a potential reality. But as soon as that happened, she started to feel the weight of all of those expectations. They started to weigh on her more and more. And so as we sat there on the park bench, she described thinking about other people's reactions. She described going home, what it would feel like. She could picture it, she said, going home and telling her mom that she had gotten into Penn and the look that would be there on her mom's face. And then she described what it would be like going home and having to tell her mom that she didn't get in, and the look of disappointment on her mom's face. And the next day, going into school, and all her friends who were so supportive of her hearing the news and being, saying, oh, sorry it didn't work out, and comforting her, and the one thing that Shannon hated more than anything was being comforted. And so here we were at this moment. All of these hopes and expectations were coming down to this one moment where she was gonna check her phone and get these results. This is a decision that would affect the rest of her life. So do you want to know what happened? Well, you got to read the book. Sorry, I'm not going to tell you. I think we're here to move some product. So the answer is there at the end of the first chapter. I don't want to spoil it. But in many ways, you know, I feel like what's important about the story is not what happens to Shannon in the end, although it is incredible. It's not what you expect. It is kind of incredible. But it's not what happens. It's the pressure that she felt and that she shared with me in that sort of remarkable time there on the bench. And when you are the adult in a situation like that, whether it's a low-income student like Shannon or an affluent kid, your own kid, someone else's kid, there's a thing you're supposed to say, right? There's a script. You're supposed to say, calm down, take it easy, relax. It doesn't matter. You're blowing this way out of proportion. It doesn't matter where you go to college. You're going to be fine no matter what happens. And I kind of tried to do that, but at the same time, it was difficult, and the reason it was difficult was because I had come to this park bench directly from JFK Airport, and I had flown there from California, where I'd been doing another piece of reporting for this book. I had been embedded for a few days on the campus of Stanford University in the lab of an economist named Raj Chetty. And Raj Chetty is becoming this very famous and influential economist. He is part of this movement in economics known as big data, these guys who take gigantic data sets and chop them up and analyze them and try to understand big trends in American life. And the trend that he was trying to understand, the phenomenon he was trying to understand, was social mobility, the same thing that interested me. And the big study that he had just come out with was a study of the intersection of social mobility and higher education. It's this report called the Mobility Report Cards. And what he did was got access to this giant IRS database, tax records going back generations, that let him trace the way that different individuals' path through higher education affected their earnings, their outcomes as adults. And he was able to trace that, the role of higher education as a whole in social mobility. He was able to trace the role of different types of institutions, and in fact he was able to trace the role of individual institutions in the process of social mobility. And the reason that it was hard for me to reassure Shannon at that moment was that Raj Chetty's big finding was that where you go to college matters a whole lot. One of his big findings was that students who go to what he calls Ivy Plus colleges, which includes the Ivy League schools plus a few other equally selective institutions, the students who go to those schools are very likely to be in the top income quintile as young adults. But one in five of them, he found, was in the top 1% in their mid-30s. And one tier down, the super selective schools that aren't quite in the Ivy League, it was just 1 in 11 chance. So only half as likely that you were going to get really rich after you got out of college. And if you went to community college, it was just a 1 in 300 chance. So where you go to school really mattered. And it especially mattered for young people like Shannon. Another remarkable finding of his was that if two individuals go to the same institution, they tend to have similar economic outcomes, even if one comes from affluence and one comes from poverty. So one student comes from a high-income home, one student comes from a low-income home, they get to the same college, and that gap between them is almost entirely erased in just 4 years. So where Shannon went would matter. But if you look at those two things, it seems like sort of a happy story about mobility, right? Like college works. It erases these giant gaps in American society. And so if Shannon did get to Penn or to Princeton, it would work for her as well. It would give her all of this opportunity despite her modest circumstances. But the problem is the third finding of Raj Chetty's, which is that students like Shannon almost never get to these institutions. One of Raj's findings is that students in the bottom quintile, so the bottom fifth of incomes, there were only 2.2% of the Princeton student body was from that bottom quintile. At Yale, it's only 2.1%. So students like Shannon are almost entirely absent from those college campuses, from the places that she was applying. So no wonder she was anxious. And obviously, Shannon is not the only one. In reality, the decision of those admissions offices might matter more to her. But if anything, the anxiety, the type of anxiety she was feeling, is more intense and more widespread in affluent neighborhoods. If you could do a heat map in the United States for higher education anxiety, there would be these glowing red markers in certain neighborhoods in, you know, Silicon Valley and Westchester County and parts of D.C. Where would it be in Philadelphia? Where? Mainline, where else? West Philly, did someone say? Yeah, so there's always a neighborhood, right? I don't know my Philadelphia geography well enough to identify it, but I bet you could get it down to the, like, 9-digit zip code. And the time when I experienced that kind of anxiety, as opposed to Shannon's anxiety, was in Washington, D.C., where I did some reporting for the book with an SAT tutor named Ned Johnson. And Ned is, I don't know if he's the best, he seemed pretty good to me, but he is certainly the most prized and best paid SAT tutor in Washington, D.C. He charges $400 an hour. He has his own company called Prep Matters, the biggest test prep company in Washington, D.C. And so I got to watch him work for a while and try to understand his role in this process of higher education and social mobility. And Ned is a great guy, really unusual, and he has these very unusual methods. So I figured, like, for $400 an hour, he would be teaching an enormous amount of content, right? He would just be somehow cramming all of this algebra and reading comprehension down kids' throats, but he wasn't at all. He wouldn't talk about the content almost at all. Instead, he would talk about life and stress and what it's like to be a young kid in an anxious, ambitious, upper-middle-class family. His theory is that if you're the type of young person who ends up in his office, which means you probably have affluent and well-educated parents, you probably know your middle school math pretty well. But the reason that you are not getting fantastic grades or fantastic scores on these tests is that you are anxious, that you're freaked out by these tests, as most students are. And Ned has spent a lot of time studying stress physiology and coming to understand the science, which is that when kids get stressed, it has a physiological effect on them. They're less likely to perform well on important activities like doing well on the SAT or the ACT. So he spends a lot of time talking to them about stress and exercise and diet and sleep. He's a big believer in sleep. One of the techniques that he uses is he talks about these tests, the ACT and the SAT, in this very dismissive way. He calls them goofy and little games and malarkey. And that's effective, he thinks. Well, there's two reasons he does it. One is he actually believes it. You know, when he's able to see how quickly he can change young people's test scores, it's hard to take these tests as seriously as you might otherwise. But also because he believes that there's a psychological game there, that if you can internalize the idea that these tests are not actually a measure of your self-worth and your place in the world or in your family or in your school, but are actually just this game, then you'll actually do better. You won't get so freaked out. You won't get so nervous. You'll think you can master it. And it kept working. Students that I would watch would go, their scores would go up by hundreds of points on the SAT, on the ACT by 6 points or 7 points or 8 points or 9 points, and his students who I met would just keep getting into Princeton and Yale and Harvard. The only young person I met in all of my travels who was as anxious about college admissions as Shannon Torres was one of Ned's students, a young woman named Ariel. And she came from a family that was very focused on higher education and very focused on elite higher education. Everyone in her family, her older siblings, had all gone to exclusive colleges. And at the end of sophomore year, her parents sat her down and said, okay, it's time to start studying. And what they meant was it's time to start studying for the SAT and the ACT. And so she spent the next year working with tutors, and she took the two tests a total of 7 times, and she got to a 26 on the ACT, which is pretty good. But her goal, her dream school, was Washington University in St. Louis. And she had calculated that to get into Washington University, she would need a 32 on the ACT, and she was stuck at a 26. So she went to Ned. And with Ned's help, they would sit there and they'd talk about algebra and they'd talk about anxiety, and her test score went up from 26 to 27 to 28 to 29 to 30 to 31, and then it stalled out again. one short of her goal of 32. And then one day, before she came into Ned's office on a weekend to do yet another practice test, she went to a soul cycle class. And she biked like crazy and got her heart rate up and got all sweaty and then came in and sat down and took the test, and she got a 32. And what Ariel derived from that was not that she had finally mastered the material or that Ned was a great tutor or that she was, you know, really smart. It was that soul cycle was the only way that she was going to be able to get a 32. And so she came up with a plan, which was that she would go to a soul cycle class right before the actual ACT. She would take the class, bike like crazy, go to the test, get another 32, get into Washington University, everything would be fine. But she and Ned ran into a problem, which is there was no soul cycle class anywhere in the DC area that was scheduled early enough on a weekend to let her take the class and make it to the test before it began. So she and Ned were working the phones, calling all over, seeing if anybody would schedule a separate class. No, no, no. And as the day approached, Ariel got more and more anxious, and her confidence started to ebb, and Ned and she could both see what was going to happen. If that happened, if she started believing that she couldn't do it, it was likely that she wouldn't. And so Ned made this generous, extravagant offer. He said, listen, if you can't get to a SoulCycle class, I will bring SoulCycle to you. And so the morning of the test, he loaded up his car with two stationary bikes. He drove to Ariel's house, set them up in her basement, and the two of them at 6 a.m. biked like crazy on their stationary bikes, music blasting, candles going. Ariel went off to take the test, and she got a 32, and she got into Washington University. So this is the part in the story where I'm supposed to tell you that Ariel is crazy, right? And Ariel is a little crazy. She is the first one to admit that she was acting a little bizarre for those couple of years. But the reality is, she is not wrong about how the system works, and neither is Shannon. It is an unfair system. That's clear when you spend time in Ned's office. These are a small group of families who can afford this test prep. Their test scores are going up. They're getting into the kind of universities that Shannon would love to go to, but she can't get that kind of test prep, and millions of other students like her can't either. And what's hard about it, I think, is that it is an unfair system where the stakes actually matter. And that combination is toxic for everybody involved. It certainly hurts low-income students the most, but I think it also is toxic for Ned students, for students like Ariel, who in many cases were spending their whole adolescence doing stuff that they didn't really care that much about, focused on this one number, this one question of where they were going to get in. And I had this moment with Ariel after I had heard all these stories, when she'd finished with all her test prep and she had gotten into Washington University, and I sat down with her and I was like, let's debrief. What do you feel about this whole period? And she actually seemed kind of stunned, like someone who had just come off a two-year bender, like she couldn't quite believe what had happened. And here's what she said to me. She said, I spent 2 years working for something that I didn't believe in. I don't believe in the SAT or the ACT. I think the system is corrupt. It's messed up. It's frankly just unfair. I worked so hard for something that I'm morally opposed to. And I asked her why she was morally opposed. And she said, I did well because I had Ned. If you have money, you can get a tutor and you can take the test 7 times. That's why I got a 32. If I had taken the test only 1 time without a tutor, I probably would have gotten a 26. And she's right. It really is unfair. What is so rare, I think, about Ariel is that she was so candid, so aware of the advantages that she'd got and how they made the system unfair. But that unfairness that's there in the system, I think it's evident to everybody. And it affects the process not just of applying to college, but also the experience of being at college. I spent a lot of time talking to first-generation students, meaning students whose parents themselves didn't go to college, first-generation students at selective colleges across the country. And anytime I was at a selective college in my reporting, I would find a student, a first-generation student to talk to, and I would ask them what their experience was like at college. And it was always a little bit different, but I would hear these familiar refrains. They would often say that they felt extremely lucky. They knew how lucky they were, how blessed they were to be at this institution, to be getting this remarkable education, often with very little expense for themselves. They often had great financial aid packages. And yet, despite that acknowledgement, they were often kind of miserable. The experience of being a first-generation student at a highly selective college is a really hard one. And that's partly just a fact of social mobility. So, you know, social mobility, the process of changing your life, especially as an adolescent, it's always hard. It's never a smooth process. You know, you are experiencing something different that you haven't before. You're renegotiating and often leaving behind your relationship with your past, with your history, with your family. So that's part of it, I think. But the other part is that they were becoming aware that they were in a place of such concentrated wealth and privilege. And that made them feel like an outsider. It was just strange being in a place where they didn't get the references and they didn't understand the clothes people were wearing or the way they talked about food or vacations or anything else. But it also gave them this awareness that they had maybe in the abstract before, but now became very concrete of how unfair the system was, and how even if they had lucked out and made it to this place, there were so many students like them who deserved to be there, who could do that work, but weren't because of the way the system works. And I think it's not just those students who are affected by this unfairness. There was a new study that came out just last month that talked about, it surveyed American college students, and it found that incidents of depression and anxiety and serious self-harm have doubled just over the last decade. Now, they don't know why this is. That probably has something to do with new technologies that make kids feel a little bit crazy. But I think it also has to do with the pressure that young people feel now being in this unfair system with such high stakes. It does make you a little bit crazy, and I think it makes you crazy whether you perceive that the system is rigged for you or against you. So what do we do? When you meet up with an unfair system that you realize somehow benefits you, what do you do? Well, there's been evidence in the news over the last year that some parents with advantages, when they experience that, they try to get even more advantages, right? You feel like, well, the system doesn't have any rules, so all bets are off. I can do anything. And the college admissions scandal around this corrupt college coach named Rick Singer is obviously the most kind of florid and dramatic example of parents losing their minds and trying to get more advantages for themselves in an unfair system. But it's not the only example. There was a story that ProPublica just did a couple months ago in the suburbs of Chicago, where some parents were actually giving up legal guardianship, affluent parents giving up legal guardianship of their kids in senior year of high school. They were like legally making their kids orphans. The kids would still live at home, but they would go through this legal process so that when they got to college, they would be eligible for financial aid, for need-based financial aid as orphans. And this was obviously aid that was intended for actual people with actual need, not make-believe need. And that sort of thing, both of those scandals, that's the way you behave if you feel like you are in a zero-sum game. If you think that higher education is not a collective good, but a consumer good, a scarce commodity, and it's your job to compete for it, for yourself and for your children. And I think that's how, over the past couple of decades, we have been trained to think. And we've trained ourselves to think as well. That higher education is a competitive marketplace. That if your kids win, then my kids lose. And if my kids win, then your kids lose. And I think that process has warped private college admissions. But the more significant cost, I think, is on the public side of higher education. Our public institutions of higher education are the real engine of social mobility in this country. They are the institutions that most students go to in the United States, and certainly most low-income students go to. And not that long ago, they functioned really well as an engine of mobility. But just over the last couple of decades, we have really, as a country, turned our backs on those institutions. We have taken funding away from them. Just since 2001, the average per pupil, per student funding at public of, let me try that again. Since 2001, each state has cut its higher education budget on a per student basis by 16%, adjusted for inflation. So we cut 16% out of this budget that didn't have that much money in it to start with. And we've done it at exactly a moment when all of the signals in the economy and in the labor market are that our young people need more and better education, more credentials, more skills. So the real imbalances in our higher education system are not about Rick Singer. They have to do with the fact that some institutions receive a lot of funding and some get a little. Some families can afford to send their kids to SAT tutors like Ned, and some can't. Some have alumni ties and well-connected friends they can call on when it's application time, and some don't. Some are able to pay the inflated tuitions that many private institutions charge, and some can't. Some know how to negotiate tuition discounts, and some don't. So if you're a parent who does have some of those advantages, what should you do? Well, I don't think it means that we can't support our kids, that we can't encourage them to do well in school and to apply to excellent colleges. I think we can even help them apply to college, though I think it would be a good idea to be a little bit more laid back than some parents have been recently. But I think we can also tell them a story about college and college choice that is not just about competition. I think we can tell them a story that prizes the collective good of higher education as well as the consumer good, so that when they get there, they will understand that they are not in a fight with the other students there, and they're not in a fight with the other students who didn't get in, that other people's education benefits them as well as themselves. And that is not the story, I think, that we're telling ourselves, and that we're telling each other, and that we're telling our children. And I think where that pushes us is that at the same time that we're trying to help our own kids do well in college, we can also advocate for a fairer and more level playing field. You know, as alumni, we can talk to the colleges we went to and encourage them to create a more level playing field for low-income and first-generation students. We can push our lawmakers to restore more funding for things like Pell Grants, which help low-income students go to college. And more important, just the funding that we've taken away from our public universities and our community colleges, so that ambitious students who don't have a lot of family money, again, would have a decent shot at a high-quality post-secondary education. In earlier eras, Americans took as an article of faith this idea that our collective public education benefits us all. We just believed it was better to live in a community or a nation where opportunity through higher education was widely shared. I think that belief has deep roots in our country. This country was founded imperfectly on the ideal of social mobility, and at other points in our history, we've done a better job of connecting that ideal to our system of higher education. So I want to close by telling you about one more student who, in my reporting, I spoke to about his college experience. In many ways, he was a lot like Shannon. He was the child of immigrants. He grew up in a low-income, working-class home. In his neighborhood, he was surrounded by people who didn't go to college and didn't even really aspire to college. And the student's name was Patrick Fay, and I went to visit him in his retirement home in a little community in Connecticut. He was 93 years old. And he grew up in a little town in Massachusetts, the son of Irish immigrants, and he loved school. His dad worked in a shipyard. His dad had stopped school after the sixth grade, but he loved school. He loved science. He loved chemistry, a lot like Shannon. And his family couldn't afford to send him to college. And so instead, in 1942, he volunteered for the Army. And he and his friends in this small town in Massachusetts were obsessed with World War II all through 1941. They'd been listening to the radio and talking about which branch of the service they would join. And when the war finally came, he joined the Army. And he spent a couple of years on different Army bases getting trained and educated, and then he went off to Europe a little bit after D-Day. He fought in the Battle of the Bulge. He was shot in the hand by a German sniper, sent back to a hospital in Paris, and then came back to the front to Germany in time to help liberate Berlin. And then he went back home. The war was won. And his last stop on the way home was an army base in Massachusetts, where he and thousands of other GIs were sat down and told about this thing called the GI Bill. So the federal government was going to take responsibility for paying for 4 years of college for every GI. And this was an amazing opportunity for Patrick Fay. It was what he had been waiting for in some ways as a kid. And so he enrolled in Northeastern in Boston, stayed there for 4 years, learned chemistry, went on, got a master's degree. And he described for me what had happened in his family after that. He got a good job in a plastics company and spent his life working in this industry. He had six kids. They all went to college, and in fact, they all went to graduate school. They had grandkids. All his grandkids went to college. He went to all of their college graduations, and now his great-grandkids were young and making their way through school, and he said, I'm not going to be around for their college graduations, but I know they're going to have these great opportunities. And when he looked back on his life and on the life of the country, he could see this hinge, and that it all changed at that moment in that tent. His grandfather was a farmer. His father was a manual laborer. His kids are well-educated, his grandkids, his great-grandkids are all well-educated and affluent and well taken care of. And he was the hinge in his family's story, from manual labor to knowledge labor. And in fact, that moment was the hinge for so many Americans, and not just for them, but for the whole country. The GI Bill, millions of young people who went to college on it helped change the way that the American economy worked. They created this middle class that created the huge post-war boom. After I met Patrick Fay, I went back and I read a bunch of books. I had sort of known the basics of the GI Bill history, but I didn't know a lot of the details. And one of the things that I found when I went back and read these books was that in Congress in 1943 and 1944, when legislators were debating the GI Bill, there was a lot of interesting debate, and the tenor of the debate was that this is, you know, good, we should be offering this, this will help these guys, but none of them are really going to go to college. I mean, college at that point, only about 10% of American young people were going to college, and it was mostly the rich and the privileged, and the GIs were not rich and privileged. You know, they were mostly the not very well-educated sons of farmers and factory workers. And so the idea that these kids might actually want to go to college seemed far-fetched. But then in 1945, as the end of the war began to approach, there was this new anxiety that started to be expressed, this new chorus of anxiety. What if these guys actually do go to college? What's going to happen then? There were the two leading voices were the president of Harvard and the president of the University of Chicago. And the president of the University of Chicago wrote this article in Collier's magazine in which he said, we have to change the system. We cannot let the GI Bill stand the way it is. We need to have some kind of test to just educate the best, you know, the smartest of them. If they all show up, he had this memorable phrase, we're going to have educational hobo jungles on our college campuses. And in lots of ways, these two guys were correct. The GIs did come back and go to college in incredible numbers. The population, the undergraduate population in the United States doubled in just a couple of years right at the end of World War II. They were putting them in tents and Quonset huts and putting them in dorms wherever they could find space. But they were wrong about a key thing as well, which is that they did not become educational hobos. The GIs were actually the best students on campus. They were incredibly motivated. They worked very hard. They outworked the rich kids who were there before. And their success changed the American idea of what a college student was and what college was for. It had been seen in the past as this elite thing for elite people. And then suddenly there were these working class sons of farmers and laborers who were succeeding. And it gave Americans this idea that higher education could play a different role in our society. I think we have forgotten a lot of what we learned in the GI Bill era, but the same principles remain true today. That what was true for Patrick Fay is true for Shannon and for Kiki and Matthew and Ori and a lot of the other students that I write about in The Years That Matter Most. That when we focus on the idea that our collective public education benefits us all, when we invest in low-income and working-class young people who want more education, then it pays off, not just for them, but for all of us. All right, I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. I am going to take some questions, and we have a couple of microphones roaming through the audience.
Do you know what the reasons for Shannon's being so set on going to Penn were, and how did it, in her case, come to be that she was so unreservedly intent on that? I mean, I don't know exactly what the standing of a school like Stony Brook is now, but I would think that all things taken and measured in balance, that a kid like that, if she's good and is not intent on, let's say, a Penn, if she were to end up at a place like Stony Brook, she could do very, very well.
Sure.
Especially if she's a hard worker. So I'm just curious, I mean, how these kids come to get these fixations on a place. Some of that is BS, right?
Sure. Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, so I think her, you know, she got fixated on Penn the same way that Ariel got fixated on Washington University, you know. There are lots of ways that you can argue that they're overly fixated, but the data that Raj Chetty came back with, which I do think is important in the aggregate, if not for every individual student, is that when you go to a more selective college, when you go to Princeton and or Penn and not Stony Brook, you have better financial outcomes. You're going to make more money as an adult. And for individual students, that might be different. But I feel like what Shannon felt like was you know, the same ambitions that Ariel has I have as well. I'm you know, as smart as her, as ambitious as her. And the reality is that if Shannon got into Penn, she would have, you know, it would be cheaper than going to Stony Brook. Stony Brook is, you know, one of the institutions that in New York State, the budget has been cut by a lot. So yeah, in the big picture, I'm with you, absolutely. Not only should kids like Shannon be able to go to Stony Brook, but we should be spending more money on Stony Brook to make it a more appealing option. But I think the reality is that you know, someone like Shannon understands that the benefit that she will get from being at Penn is potentially and on average more than the benefit that she would get from Stony Brook. And so the question is, you know, do we want to make that path as available for her as it is for someone like Ariel? Yeah, I mean, you know, she went to Penn. She loved it. It felt like the place that she wanted to be. She described. No, she didn't go to Penn. She went to Penn before. Well, she might have gone to Penn. I'm not going to say. She's trying to trick me. But she had been to Penn, is what I'm trying to say, is as a high school student, she had visited Penn, and she had loved it. So you know, I think we can talk with any kids, whether they're affluent or non-affluent, about where their ideas about a certain college comes from. I just think that, you know, Shannon deserves all the same kind of opportunities as those affluent kids do.
Thank you very much. I also heard you speaking on the radio this morning.
Oh, great.
At length, and appreciated that interview
On Radio Times?
Yeah.
Yeah, she is. She's such a great host. It was
yeah,
fun.
So you were talking, you know, this evening about, you know, the colleges wanting to accept students whose parents can pay. And you were talking this morning also about the push in admissions offices. How do the colleges know which students, when they apply, have parents who can pay? Is there a question on admissions that say, will you be seeking financial aid?
It's a good question. I think the answer is yes. I should know the answer to that. But I mean, I don't think it's quite that literal, but I do think that students file the FAFSA form at the same time as they file their application. And so I think colleges can find out that way. But I think there are also other clues in terms of where you live and where you went to school and what kind of sports you do and all the other markers of affluence and non-affluence in society. But I do think that they have pretty decent information about who can pay. Yeah, so I was talking on Radio Times today about this section of my book that is connected to an article that is going to be in the New York Times Magazine this Sunday that is about admissions directors, and so I spent a lot of my early reporting hanging out with people like Shannon and Ariel, and for them, you know, and people who work in admissions are these gods on Mount Olympus who have all of the power and are sort of doling out acceptances and rejections and then cashing the giant tuition checks. And then I started spending time with admissions people and realized that they didn't see the world that way at all. They felt under tremendous stress. They are the people who are most responsible for keeping their institutions afloat, and at many private institutions that aren't in the very top tier of endowments, this is a very difficult financial moment. And so they have to think like salespeople. They have to look for customers who can pay, and that's hard for a lot of reasons that I go into in the article and in the book. But it's partly hard just sort of technically to find enough people who can pay your tuition. But it's also hard because the message that many of us want to send about higher education, and certainly people in the, you know, the communications office and the president's office at the university want to send this message that higher ed admissions is a meritocracy, and that the goal is for more socioeconomic diversity. And, you know, I think that is a genuine goal in the hearts of many higher education administrators, but the reality in the admissions office is you've got to make your number. You've got to bring in enough tuition revenue.
Hi, thanks for coming down. I wanted to try to ask the first question again.
Great.
Because I'm not sure. I think that everybody agrees that at all schools, we should do a better job of being more egalitarian and admitting people who otherwise would have trouble getting there. I think that wasn't, as I understood it, the question. I think that what if we were to simply go back to what college actually does, which is to teach?
Mm-hmm.
You managed to spend the half hour, and you used the word, I don't think you used the word teaching at all, and the word education or educate came up only a few times in connection with the word hire.
Mm-hmm.
But if we remove from college the need to be the major motor of social mobility in the country and simply look at it for what it actually does, which is teach various subjects, it turns out that at a vast number of colleges in almost every location in America, there are great teachers who do a fabulous job of communicating the things that need to be communicated and the discussions that need to be had. It is not better to go to Harvard than it is to go to Stony Brook for those purposes. And therefore, all of this pressure seems to be a kind of hype that is put onto the system. And wouldn't it all be simply a lot easier if we were to simply explain that the education that an graduate school may be a slightly different thing, but for undergraduates, it really, as a matter of education, if you choose a school that has the field that you're interested in, and there are hundreds of those around the country that most students can get into, it really is not going to be different than if you, in fact, probably going to a place like Harvard is going to give you, for various reasons, a less interesting education than you would get at having attention paid to you at a place like Stony Brook. Isn't that really the solution to the problem?
It's an interesting idea. So I would encourage you to read the book, and especially the second chapter, because I write about a lot of economists who have analyzed that question of what happens in different colleges and what happens to students in different places. Raj Chetty is one of them. Carolyn Hawksby is another from Stanford. And they see real differences. So I guess I have a few different answers. I mean, one answer is that, like, if we're going to tell students to go to less selective institutions, I want to start with Ariel rather than Shannon, right? Like, so, and I feel like there. I think maybe a part of why I bristled at that first question was the idea that it was Shannon who was the one who was taking the college that she was going to do seriously. I think we sort of accept that a kid like Ariel is going to go crazy and go to Washington University, but I feel like there's a way that when we see Shannon's story, we feel like maybe she doesn't belong there. And I think that's the message that she got throughout her life, and that was the message that she was feeling anxious about sitting on that park bench. And I absolutely feel like Shannon belongs in those institutions, or any institution, as much as Ariel does. And so that I think feel like that's part of my answer. I also feel like Absolutely. There are ways that you can find great educations at any kind of institution. But I feel like things have also changed in over the last while because we have been cutting back our public education budgets. And I think things are different at Stony Brook than they were. I mean, yeah, so one of the professors who I follow up, but there are some teachers in the book. I follow a calculus professor who teaches at the University of Texas. I spent a semester in his class, and he had gone to City College in New York City in the 1950s. And I spent some time at City College as well, and City College has changed, and it's mostly changed because we have cut back the amount of money that we spend on it. And money does make a difference. You know, when you spend less on education, you have different professors, you have fewer services. You know, I followed one student, a low-income student at Princeton, and I went with her, her name's Kiki Gilbert, and I went with her to a class called the Humanities Sequence at Princeton. And it is this tradition that I hadn't known about before, where only about 60, maybe 100 students in the freshman class go through this process, this year-long course where they read all of these great books. There are like 10 different professors assigned to it. They have these small seminars where they sit and talk. And so I sat there with her, and she was a low-income African-American student, and she was surrounded at this table by mostly rich white kids. And so I was sort of watching their different experiences, but I could not deny the excellent education that they were getting. They were having there was a Rhodes Scholar poet sitting at this table with 16 of them, who was an amazing teacher, analyzing this text on an extremely high level. And so I'm not saying that doesn't happen at Stony Brook, but I also think that we need to resist feeling like it's just a mirage, what is happening at those institutions. Because, first of all, when you're there, when I was sitting there in that class, there was a whole lot of value being transmitted, both educationally and economically, I feel like, to those students. And it matters, I think, what kind of students are there. Because when you look at the economics data, there is no question that when you look at Stony Brook and you look at Penn, lifetime earnings outcomes are much higher for students who graduate from Penn. And what this economist Carolyn Hawksbee has shown, that is not just a selection effect. That has to do if two people get into both those schools and choose one and not the other, their income goes up. So we can talk about why that is. Does it have to do with the education? Does it have to do with the knowledge? Does it have to do with the connections they made? Does it have to do with a sheepskin effect? Probably some combination of those things. But I do think we have to wrestle with the fact that the evidence shows there are economic benefits to going to those more selective schools. And I don't, you know, I do want to ramp down the competition. I do want to ramp down the pressure on a student like Shannon so that there would be other great institutions for her to go to and get a great education that's going to allow her to have the life that she wants. But I feel like the solution is not just convincing her to go to a less selective institution. It is changing those institutions so that we have what we had not that long ago, which is a really robust and excellent public education system that is consistently educating low-income students and giving them the tools they need to experience social mobility.
For 20 years, I've taught right four blocks from here at Philadelphia Community College of Philadelphia.
Excellent.
I adore my students. Many are very hardworking. Many have great talent. Some of them we transfer to Brown, to Ivy schools.
Excellent.
However, the biggest problem for most of them is low incomes and the need to work an unprecedented number of hours a week in order to even take two courses a week. I have many students currently trying to take three or four courses, i.e. a full-time load, while working 30 to 35 hours a week. Of course, they can't get the 40 hours because then they would have to be paid benefits. All right. But my question is this. At this very moment, as you know, we have many Democratic presidential candidates bandying around ideas about funding higher education.
Right. We might hear some later tonight.
I would not dare to ask you if you're supporting any of those candidates. But what I will ask you is there a position currently espoused that makes any sense to you, such as at least community colleges, two-year colleges should be free, or that four-year colleges for parents who earn less than, say, some arbitrary figure such as 80,000 should be free? Do you have any opinion about that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, so I'm not a policy guy, and so I can't sort through all the details of those policies, but those two sound pretty good to me. Like, I do think that public higher education should be somewhere between free and cheap. I think there are two problems when if you're trying to do that, if you're trying to move in that direction, there are two pitfalls. And I feel like, again, not being an expert, but what I see in the two big plans, Bernie Sanders's and Elizabeth Warren's plans to make public college cheaper or free, I think there are two potential problems. One is that right now higher education benefits wealthy kids more than poor kids, right? So anything that would just make higher education free would benefit rich kids more than poor kids, which is not a particularly progressive point of view. For instance, I mean, I can't remember which one of them it is who wants to eliminate student debt. The problem with eliminating student debt is that most of the student debt is held by well-off graduates of college who actually have a lot of earning power because they've gone to college. So that is not a particularly progressive move. But I think it could be. I think you could adjust those ideas to make them more progressive. The other thing is that I feel like just cutting tuition only solves part of the problem. And so you tell me your experience at Philadelphia Community College, but when I talk to people at community colleges and public universities, and when I look at the data from economists who study this, they say that tuition is part of the problem, but more of the problem is just that there's not enough funding. You know, there's not enough funding of these institutions to pay professors, to have tutors, to have advisors, all of the stuff that at a highly resourced university surrounds students. And obviously, the students who are at a community college need that help more, not less. The kind of tutoring and advising and counseling that helps students actually graduate is less likely to be present there. And what these economists found is that when public universities cut their funding, or have their funding cut, the first thing that they get rid of is student support, so is advising and counseling and tutoring, because it's hard to cut other things. But that means that it's harder than ever for those students to graduate. So I think it's great that we're talking about it, and I find it really heartening that those candidates are thinking about how to make higher education better and fairer, but I think those two words matter more to me than cheaper. Cheaper would be good too, but better and fairer is more important.
This is absolutely fascinating to me. I am first generation college graduate with a terminal degree, and I am raising a daughter who is very ambitious academically.
What age, may I ask?
16. She's in Japan right now, actually, for a semester abroad, studying in Japan. Speaks Japanese. It's a whole interesting thing.
Yeah.
So she's living a life that is quite different from what I lived as first-generation public school-educated student. But what I guess troubles me in the midst of all of this discussion about education and social mobility is what the gentleman in the front, I think, was pointing out, that, you know, what is the purpose for all of this? And when I think of my child and how she is going through her life, I want her to be happy. Regardless of where she goes, I just want her to be happy. Not only do I want her to be happy, but I want her to study something that truly interests her and inspires her and will lead her to a career that will actually be something that's fulfilling. Because in the end, that's what this is all about. That's what we're on this earth for, is to be fulfilled and seek some kind of happiness without all of the pressure of all of this. But in the middle of all of this is my job. And right now, workforce development initiatives are very prominent and very serious conversations that we're having. And what troubles me is that we have all of these students who are interested or who are ambitious to get into certain schools, but what are their majors going to be? And what kind of income are they going to earn with those majors? And what we're finding is that people are getting into these institutions without those considerations, and then they graduate with tons of debt because they didn't major in things that were actually going to yield the incomes that they actually need to pay off the debt that they've incurred. So I guess I say all of this to say that there's something to be said about something beyond just getting into these schools, beyond just social mobility. There's something about just the fulfillment of education and learning to live and to earn a living and a happy living, and not just this pursuit of getting into an elitist school.
And so when you see that, so your daughter, is she starting her junior year? Or?
Junior year.
Yeah, so you're about to be in the thick of it, right? So, and does she, do you feel like she appreciates that idea of wanting to sort of fulfill herself, or is she just focused on getting into the right college and getting the right credential?
She's all about fulfilling herself, because I have not put on that pressure of, you know, getting into some Ivy school. She attends, actually, she lives a whole different life than I did. I'm public school educated. She's in a private school right now. And it's affording her opportunities that I didn't have at her age. I didn't go abroad until I was in college. She is a junior, and this is her second time in Japan, actually. So she's living a life that's quite different from what I lived, and I'm really focused on her happiness and her fulfillment as an adult when she's in her career, versus focusing on getting into a school, incurring mass amounts of debt because she just majored in something because she thought it was the right thing to do.
Right. That's a great story. And I mean, you know, there are lots of ways that your life story sounds like a story of social mobility through higher education. And I feel like you are getting to, at this point that I try to get to in the book, which is that part of what makes this question so hard, it makes it so hard for us to think about the intersection of these two forces, is that you know, the way an economist looks at a college education is very different than the way that a parent or a student or a professor looks at a college education, right? And so I don't think that means we need to ignore the economist, but I do think that that conflict is at the heart of a lot of why this is hard for us to find solutions to, because for a young person, wherever you go, those years are this remarkable period of transformation, right? That's, you're usually living away from home for the first time. You are finding your identity. You're figuring out who you are, what you want to be. You're making all kinds of mistakes. Let's hope not too dramatic ones, and figuring out how to recover from those. You're figuring out your relationship with your family and your parents, and that is some of the most important stuff that happens. And I actually think that that is not separate from, you know, what economists describe as like gaining increasing your human capital, right? Because the reality is that when you go off into the workplace, your process of having gone through that, figuring yourself out, is, I think, directly connected to the way the rest of your life is going to go, as much as any knowledge that you've gained. And certainly there are some professions where, and this is where I feel like that major question is important, but I feel like it can also be overplayed. You know, there are some professions where exactly what courses you take and what your major are really matter a lot. But Kiki, the student that I was following at Princeton, is a philosophy major, right? And there are ways that you were a philosophy major? Well, so there you go. So there are ways, you know, that I feel like certain politicians would say, like, philosophy, like, it's a waste of time. This is like the problem with college, is you're sitting around reading these old books and you're not gaining skills. But sitting there in the humanities sequence with Kiki, I was going back and forth between reporting on Kiki at Princeton and reporting on a welding student at a community college in North Carolina named Ori. And what struck me was that, you know, we use the economist language when we think about Ori, that he's like getting skills that are going to get him a job, and we use the sort of the like humanities language when we think about Kiki, right? She's learning all these deep things, but sitting there in that humanities sequence with all these white kids and Kiki, I realized like they are learning job skills, right? They are learning really marketable job skills, and it's great that they are also learning philosophy. But in a knowledge economy, the kind of skills you're learning, how to sit around a table and argue your point and read deeply in a text and analyze things and figure them out, and all of the other stuff that's going on for those students, are not only job skills, they happen to be incredibly valuable job skills at this particular moment. So So I'm with you that it matters what students choose, but I think actually for students who have some advantages, as your daughter now does, in ways that if I hear you correctly, you didn't. I feel like there's a way that that they are benefiting from that higher education in ways that are hard to parse, to sort of disentangle and pull apart. Great. That's it. Thank you all so much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.